All right, so as usual, let me start by asking whether you have any questions on what we did last class. Speak now or forever hold your peace. Next question is, do you have any questions on or comments about the reading for this class, which was basically two chapters of a book arguing you should abolish IP law? Yes?
There is one part in chapter 3 where he was comparing the 19th century mind engine improvement system to
yes.
open source software. Can you clarify?
Sure. He's arguing that in each case, you had people who were deliberately making improvements and publicizing them so other people could improve on them. All right, so it's an interesting argument. I don't know if he's right or not. I mean, that's true of the book in general. But the argument is that the investors in coal mines diversified, that because coal mines were risky, if you wanted to invest in coal mines and corn, wherever it was, you would invest a little bit in each of a bunch of coal mines. That meant that if a improvement in steam engines was made in one mine, you would be in favor of having the information shared, because then all your investments would go up because they'd be able to pump more cheaply and therefore make more money for you. Whereas if you were invested in only one mine, then you would say, well, let's keep secret our improvement because we don't want to help our competitors. That would be the basic form of the argument. And that the result, therefore, was an environment like open source where the people who made improvements tried to publicize them in order that people could then build on those improvements and make further improvements. Right. And that's an interesting claim. One of the things I was doing yesterday was sort of Googling around to try to find about other sources of information. And one of the things I found was a claim in Wikipedia that one of the inventors of a steam engine, Post Watt, who, according to this book, did not patent his steam engine and made it available to everybody. This other source said, well, actually, he took out a patent in 1802, I think was the date. They gave a specific date. So which is right, I don't know. They're basically, both of them are citing sources. They're citing different sources. I emailed one of the authors, since I know him, of the book, and said, you know, we've got a contradiction between what your source says and what this one says, and his basic answer was, I ought to check it out. So don't know if it's true or not. But that is a... That is a problem. That is, I think any book like this, you should always be a little skeptical, in the sense that the authors know which side they're on. Even if they're honest, and as far as I know they are, they're likely to sort of implicitly filter the data, to be more skeptical anytime somebody says something that doesn't fit their theory than something that does. So one of the things I try to do in a book like this is to try to think of all the reasons I can why they might be wrong. All the possible flaws in their argument. Now, having done that, it doesn't mean that they are wrong. It just means that, yes, this is an interesting case. Yes, it might be right. If you're interested in it, you might want to explore it further. But you can't sort of take it at face value. Other people's? But I wanted to say a little bit before we go into the details of this particular one about the general problem of using evidence to reach conclusions about the effect of legal rules, because it's a problem that runs across a whole lot of different issues, not just this one. And it, in a sense, the problem of statistics. And let me start with an example that got quite a lot of attention some time ago. I'm not sure if it is at the moment or not. And that's the effect of the death penalty. All right. The question is, the one argument for the death penalty is it will deter murders. All right. And if you believe that each time you execute a murderer, the result is that you have three fewer murders that occur, that sounds like a pretty good deal. Even if you don't much like the idea of executing people, better to execute the guilty than the innocent. All right. That's a plausible argument. You can think of other arguments, obviously. So then the question is, how do you find out whether the death penalty deters murders or not? And the earliest literature I know of on this, which was anti-death penalty, said, look, let's look at states. And the claim, which I assume was true, it's not something I've looked at myself, was that on average, states that had the death penalty had higher murder rates than states that didn't. All right. What's wrong with that argument? Why is that not a very convincing, not that there's no evidence of it, but why isn't it a very convincing argument? Yeah? Can you go further? Are there reasons that that pattern might exist?
Well, if that, you have a society that has more murder, they'd be more likely to implement a death penalty.
That's the simplest argument is the causation could go the other direction. That is, it might be that the political pressure for a death penalty goes up when there are a lot of murders. But you can think of a variety of other possible reasons. For example, you might argue that low-income states are likely to have higher murder rates than high-income. I don't know if it's true, but it seems sort of plausible enough that, you know, poor people can't take as many precautions, have stronger incentive to kill people to steal things. You can think of lots of possible reasons that might be true. It might also be the case that a poor state, the political pressure is, why spend a whole lot of money keeping somebody in jail for 50 years? We can hang him much more cheaply. So you can imagine that income would feed into both things separately and give you that correlation. And you can check that one. You can see whether or not there's a correlation between average incomes, murder rates, and death penalty. I don't know if there is or not. I'm making up possible explanations to sort of make the point of why you can't easily tell. You could also imagine it culturally. Suppose we've got some states where the people are sort of, they're wimps. They regard killing people as a horrible thing. And one result is they hardly ever kill anybody, and another is that they disapprove of the state executing murderers. All right. And another one, they're all sort of tough He-Man types, and you argue with me, bang, I'll blow you away. And by the way, those murderers, let's hang them high as we can. So you could imagine that as well. So that's one of the general problems that arises. There's a second problem. Now, I should say there was then a later generation of more serious work. And the next important one was on the other side. And that was a multiple regression study, which looked at death penalty across and murder rates across states and across time and other variables as well. So it tried to do the kind of multiple regression where you're saying it depends on umpteen different things. Can we separate out the effect of each of them? And it got a huge pro-death penalty result. It was something like 10 lives saved for every execution. And that, of course, got a lot of flack from the other side. And then there's been further research, and I haven't really followed it. I'm not really a statistician, so I'm not sure I could evaluate the fancier ones. But I think it's still an open question as far as I can tell. And that some people will say, well, yes, that first study was very well, but the reason he got his result was the following feature of it. And so, further problem, and this is the one which I think is not going to be obvious if you haven't studied statistics, and that's what we refer to as a specification search. Suppose that you want to show that the death penalty deters murder. And so you set up a multiple regression in which you say, all right, let's see if we've got a dry erase marker. You say, let's suppose that the murder rate, suppose this doesn't work. That the murder rate depends on a bunch of variables, and so it's going to be some constant level plus V times the unemployment rate in the state plus C times the percentage of young adult males, because young adult males, we all know, are the people who commit crimes and have traffic accidents, plus death penalty. And the death penalty is going to be a binary variable. It's one if they had the death penalty, it's zero if it doesn't. And you run your regression, and damn it, you don't get any good evidence that the death penalty deters murder. Let's try this again. Maybe it doesn't really depend on the unemployment rate, but on the logarithm of the unemployment rate, which means that when you double the unemployment rate, you don't double this factor, you just increase it by a little bit. So we put in log of unemployment rate. Now let's run the regression again. Did it work? Well, maybe we're missing a variable. Maybe it also depends on the climate, that murders are more likely in warm weather when people are out and in cold places. They're all in their houses all the time. So let's add another variable for climate, which is some measure of how many days are below freezing, let's say. Let's run it again. We keep doing this, all right? And we do it both by different experiments on what other variables are, because we don't really know a priori what's going to determine it, and different ways of including them. Maybe some of them are multiplicative. Maybe it's the unemployment rate times the poverty rate. And we run 100 different regressions. And sure enough, one of them gives us a strong result that the death penalty deters murder. In fact, it's so strong that the chance that we would have gotten this good a result by chance is only 1 in 100. All right. Do you see what's wrong with this? I have just done 100 experiments. It is not surprising if when you do 100 experiments, you get a 1 in 100 unlikely chance once out of it. All right. That's a specification search. A specification search means trying your regression with different specifications, different ways of setting it up, until you find one that works. And if the objective is to get information, it's not an absurd procedure. Because when you finally get the one that works, you say, aha, looks as though the important variables are this, this, and this, and not that. But if you only report the result and not the fact that it's 1 out of 100, it looks as though the evidence for your theory is much, much stronger than it really is. All right? Makes sense? That, as I think I may have mentioned before, one of the problems with the ways in which statistical results get reported and misunderstood is that people think that that 0.01 significance means the odds are there's only a 1% chance that your theory is wrong. But what it actually means is only a 1% chance that the evidence for your theory would be this good if the theory were wrong. And that's not at all the same thing. If we have other reasons to believe your theory is wrong, we would say, well, you made a 1 in 100 gamble, so to speak. And if we know you tried it 100 times, it now becomes very unimpressive. So those aren't really about this particular reading, but they are about the general issue which you're going to face in lots of other contexts, and also which you're going to face possibly if you're litigators. If somebody brings in statistical evidence, one of the things you want to think about is, how do I debunk it? Or if you're using statistical evidence, is it really good or not? I recommend an old book called How to Lie with Statistics. Easy to read. My kids read it when they were young, but it's also readable by grown-ups. And it's basically about how not to be fooled by bad statistical arguments. Let me now go on to getting a little bit closer by mentioning another author who was a skeptic of a different part of the conventional story. Because if you think of the general argument for why we need IP law, the argument is that individuals need an incentive to invent stuff, and this is the way of giving it to them. Well, a different way of giving it to them is prizes, and a different way is subsidizing scientific research, so that a standard argument, which is not the same as the patent law argument, but it's really the same issue, is people say, look, fundamental research isn't patentable, but we need an incentive to do it. So we need a National Science Foundation or various other similar organizations to subsidize. And there is a British biochemist by the name of Terence Keeley, whose work is the equivalent of the book you're reading, except that he is attacking government subsidies for science arguments rather than IP arguments. And the claim he makes, I've heard him speak, I haven't actually read his book, is that there are a number of historical incidents where you've got some field of science which suddenly becomes fashionable and the government pours money into it. And that if you really look at what's happening, you don't observe any increased progress as a result of that. So he's making, it's interesting, it's really the same kind of argument these people are making. And his explanation, part of his explanation, is that he thinks just as part of the argument against IP is to say there are other mechanisms by which innovators can get rewarded, things like first mover advantages. So he argues that what's going on with fundamental research is that if you are a company doing work derivative from the fundamental research, work which depends on other people's fundamental research, you want to know what's going on. In particular, you want to have a heads up about what breakthroughs might happen next year, because they might mean that the product line you're designing is going to be obsolete before you get it out the door. How do you get that heads up? By having employees who are part of the set of people doing the fundamental research. And that's his argument, at least, is that just as part of the argument on why open source works is that one advantage of being part of the group developing open source software is the other people in the group will talk to you. Consequently, if you've got a problem you can't solve, someone else who can solve it will do it for you. So his argument is that similarly, part of the advantage of being one of the people doing basic research in some scientific field is that it means that you will know what the other people in that field are up to, and that's valuable information for your employer, and therefore he's arguing you've got indirect ways of subsidizing basic research. Now, again, I don't know if he's right or not, but I thought it was intriguing because it's really the same issue coming up in a slightly different context. Terence Keeley is the guy, and I think you can find his book on Amazon if you want to read it. I've heard him speak. I haven't actually read the book, though I probably should. All right, let's then go and look at what is the evidence that's offered in the stuff you've just read, and see, in particular, can you see any flaws in their argument? Can you see reasons for skepticism about the pretty convincing case they're making against IP? Anybody have proposals, examples? Persuaded all of you? You're all going to, from here on, you're all campaigning against the patent and copyright law, and you certainly would never think of actually going into the field and trying to enforce these evil and wicked and destructive laws. No. No. Better think up some arguments against it. So their claim, their very basic claim, with a whole lot of examples, is for this pattern. I'm going to graph some unknown measure of the rate of innovation. And their claim is that what happens is that at some point, some field takes off. A lot of progress, lots of good stuff happens. Somewhere around here, IP law comes in. Somewhere around here, the plant breeders persuade the government to pass a plant patent act. The litigators persuade the courts that business methods can be patented, stuff like that. And they claim, lo and behold, what happens? Innovation slows. Right? That's, if you look at it, the guts of their argument, it seems to me. Now, in principle, you could say there's another half to their argument. The other half to the argument is just this part without this, namely, here are various areas where we haven't done the experiment. We've never found out what happens if new plot ideas for mysteries or for... How many of you have read The Lord of the Rings? The book, not the movie. All right. As you may know, when that book came out, there really was no such genre as fantasy. There are some predecessors. You can point at a handful of works. If you go into a bookstore now, there are, you know, shelves and shelves full of fantasy novels, some of which are bad imitations of Tolkien, some of which are good original work by other authors. So you could argue that what Tolkien was doing was the same kind of thing that Patton is supposed to be rewarding. He was creating a set of ideas which gave opportunities for a whole bunch of other writers, which he never pocketed the money for. Yet, Boulder and Levine will tell us, we observe he wrote it. We observe that there is progress in various areas, dress design is another one, where we've never had IP effectively, and yet where people compete in a lively fashion to create new stuff. So part of their argument is this part. One thing that struck me, though, looking at the chapter, is that they sometimes have, I'm thinking now about agricultural output, they have a graph that goes like this, roughly, and they say, look, evidence for our theory, no increase in innovation after IP. Yeah, but no decrease either. All right, so in fact, they're making two claims. One claim is that you don't need IP, and the other is that IP is perverse. All right, they're arguing, if you go through the book, that patent law slows innovation. Well, this is evidence that IP has no effect at all, insofar as you can tell. All right. Different problem. Suppose you saw this pattern, and suppose you saw it in several different fields, and suppose you believe in IP. How would you go about explaining this pattern away? What's the just as in my death penalty case, what is an alternative explanation of why it's not implausible that this pattern would occur, even if patent law is a good thing? Yes? That's right. Putting it differently, the phrase I've seen used in other contexts is low-hanging fruit. All right? You have some new thing that opens up. The computer technology means that instead of computers being big things that only belong to big universities, now anybody who wants can have one on his desk. It was a very sudden change, I should say. My father had more or less his own computer, I'd have to guess probably in the 1960s. Didn't belong to him, it belonged to the University of Chicago. It was the size of a desk. And he could use it and I'm sure it was much less powerful than my cell phone is now. All right, in terms of what was there. So within, I first encountered word processors. Let me guess how long ago that would have been. Let me guess 30 years ago. I'd have to No, it's got to be a little more than that because it's before. Anyway, 35 years ago, I spent a quarter visiting at University of California, Irvine. And University of California, Irvine had a dedicated word processing system, a weighing system. And the way the system worked was that the professor typed his article. He then gave the article to the word processing ladies. They retyped it into the word processor. They printed it out and sent it to him. He marked his corrections, and they put the corrections in. And I looked at this process, and it occurred to me that as far as I could tell, the word processor ladies really had negative productivity. That is to say, it would be easier if I typed the thing myself into the word processor, because it's easier to type into a word processor than it is to a typewriter, because you can change things as you go, at which point you eliminate them and reduce instead of increasing them. And the word processor ladies were nice people, so I went in and I asked them, can you show me how to use this machine? And they showed me how to use the machine, and I arranged to use the machine in the evening when it wasn't being used, and I wrote a draft of a book that I never published, if I remember correctly, on something I was teaching at the time. And at that point, I concluded that obviously I had to have a word processor. I mean, it was just, it's just crazy, you know. I mean, I might as well be using clay bricks cuneiform as these primitive typewriters. I always use a typewriter. My handwriting is horrible. And so I looked around, and it turned out that there were two ways I could have a word processor at the time. And say this is maybe 35 years ago, 30 years ago, something like that. One way of having a word processor was to buy a dedicated word processing system, a low-end version of what the university had aimed at one person. The other way was to buy a personal computer and a printer, and a word processing program. These two alternatives cost about the same amount of money. Well, given that the personal computer did lots of other things as well, there wasn't an internet at the time, but there are other interesting things you can do with such as statistics with a computer, it seemed pretty obvious what you should do. This was back, I think, before the IBM personal computer existed. If I remember correctly, the two dominant machines of the time were the Radio Shack, the TRS-80, and the Apple II, also long before the Macintosh. And what I ended up getting was something called an LNW80, which was a super clone of the TRS-80, running at a blazing 4 megahertz, which any of you who are computer people will realize does not sound very fast nowadays, but that was about twice the speed of the TRS-80 that it was a clone of. Nice machine, LNW80. I wrote books that did get published on that one, and I'm still fond of it, although it's sitting in a box in my basement somewhere. But that was a very striking transition. But think about if in a period of, let's say, 10 years, computers go to something that essentially no private person has, to something that 5 or 10% of the population have. There are suddenly a whole bunch of potential inventions, a whole bunch of different ways in which this technology could do useful things. Games, spreadsheets. Spreadsheets, one of the great inventions of the 20th century, even though it never got patented. Word processor, obviously. Database, probably drawing programs, art. If you start thinking about it, and you can certainly, it doesn't seem unreasonable to say, once the machinery is there, there's going to be a whole bunch of low-hanging fruit, a whole bunch of really neat ideas that everybody will think of. And after a while, they're going to start running out. And when they say, and if it's the case, it doesn't seem all that implausible, that the law tends to lag the technology, so this is a new area, and so we don't know whether it's patentable or not, but by the time that there are lots of big firms in it, lots of people involved, lots of money involved, now there's pressure to introduce IP, and so the IP comes in at about the point when you've exhausted the resource, as it were, and slowing down. So that would, excuse me, be one way in which you could explain it away, and then you'd like to look and to see whether, to look at their stories in more detail, as it were, which maybe they can do, and to see whether that's an adequate explanation or whether it looks more as, for example, it would be nice to know whether sometimes the pattern looks like that. All right, because in the story I'm telling, you'd expect some connection, but no particular reason. It might take a while to get the IP. Or it might look like that instead. It might be that sometimes you get it before you exhaust it. So that would be one way of trying to look at it. And also part of what they're trying to, yeah.
I was just wondering, do we assume that the demand for innovation is like a steep, steady curve? Because sometimes there might be a delay. This might be sort of rewording what we were just talking about, but there's probably a delay when new technology is invented to where people are
comfortable with it. Yeah, so that might also be the case, that And in particular, if you think about the kind of feedback with something like a cell phone or a personal computer, which is first it becomes possible to make personal computers at a price which makes them not what everybody can easily afford, but within the range. A lot less expensive than an automobile. But I think my LNW cost maybe $1,000, $2,000, that kind of sum, back when that was real money, right? There's been some inflation since then. So you can imagine that what happens is it becomes possible to do it, and a few enthusiasts. I remember I had a colleague at VPI who had an Apple II. That was, I think, the first personal computer that I encountered, and I remember playing a rather fun computer game with him on it. And so first a few enthusiasts have it. And then some people say, well, for these enthusiasts, let's provide some interesting software. But as the amount of software goes up, now it becomes more and more, well, everybody's got to have it because, my kids want to be able to play this tank game. Back when I was at VPI, I got one of the early video games, which was tanks fighting each other, and I attached it to the television set that had been sitting unused because I don't watch television for a decade or so, and discovered that I couldn't tell which direction the tanks were pointing. So I got a new television set. That's the last television set I bought 30 years ago or something. But that was a use. And, I didn't have a small kid to be an excuse for doing it. I just thought they were fun myself. But you can see that you could have a feedback where the new technology becoming possible doesn't automatically result in everybody having it because most people see no use to it. But then as more software is written and just as people find out about it, it shows up in movies and in novels, and one of your friends, crazy, enthusiast techie friends has it and so forth and so on. Yeah?
I think there's also a degree of companies manufacturing obsolescence maybe that's something I took a bit. They have to take a while to exhaust whatever profit they can get out of the current model. Otherwise, people are just going to get upset that you keep increasing.
Well, but the problem, that might work if you're a monopoly, but it's sort of hard to do if there are a bunch of other firms because, IBM didn't introduce the graphic interface, and then Apple did, and then IBM wasn't doing it. Microsoft was doing it eventually, but had to, in effect, imitate what Apple and Atari and somebody else had done. It was originally Xerox PARC was what originally did the original version of what we now know as the graphic interface. But yeah.
But to some degree, each player in that realm is sort of looking closely at their competitors and holding on to that as long as they can, right?
But each one is going to say, if the competitor is the one that's doing well, then I want to make the innovation. There's an interesting, it's somewhat of a tangent, but it's an interesting issue. There's an argument that's made in sort of the modern antitrust literature for what are called network externalities. And the claim basically, and certainly there's some truth to it clearly, and the claim is that what you want is not just a word processor that works, but a word processor that other people are using so you can easily interchange files with them. And therefore the claim is there's sort of a lock-in once somebody's got a dominant position in the market that they are then in a position to maintain that position even without having a better product. And there's an interesting book which is sort of a critique of this literature, which looked at the history of software. And their claim is that if you really look at the pattern, at any given time, there's usually a dominant product. And one reason for this is that you've got a fixed cost of developing a product, a low cost of making copies, and therefore it's cheaper if you're selling 10 million copies than if you're selling 100,000 copies. But they say the usual pattern is that if you monitor the reviews in the magazines, at some point some other product comes out which the reviews all say is better, and then it flips. And you have a new dominant product. And they ran through a series of examples of that pattern. So it's a sort of a successive competition rather than a simultaneous competition where if you win it, you're Photoshop or your Word, and you are the main one people are using. On the other hand, there are always other people sort of on the edge of that, and once in a while, one of those other people really makes something that people think are better, and then you tend to flip. Yeah. Anyway, that's an interesting literature as well, but not I don't know. It's an IP only to the extent that it's an antitrust one, because that was some of the arguments that went into the Microsoft antitrust case was network externality arguments. Yeah.
I was thinking another reason you might have this finding is that maybe once these firms get a lot of capital, they can start hiring lobbyists.
Lobbyists to do what is the question?
To institute an IP regime,
yes. Right. But then the question is, why is it then flattened out? And one answer is because they've exhausted the possibilities. A different answer is because they're then lobbyists get an IP regime, which makes innovation harder to do. One of the points which I, at least so far, haven't noticed in the Baldwin and Levine book, but which to me is a serious argument, is that even aside from anybody trying to do anything evil, the existence of a lot of patents makes the cost of innovation harder, because it means the innovator's got to research to make sure he's not violating a patent. That given the possibility of independent invention, which clearly exists in the patent area, even if everything was done right, so to speak, there would still be the fact that the more patents there are there in your field, the more expensive it is to bring an innovation out and be reasonably sure nobody else is going to have a good claim against it. Now, a different point, which I don't think they make, though it's really implicit in what they're saying, but not explicit, is that arguably the risk of judicial error is going to be higher in a new field. That if you think about the question of, is this novel? All right, because one of the arguments that's made in the software world, at least, about against patents is to say, look, they're giving patents for things that everybody knew how to do already. And that's not, it seems to me, an absurd idea if the judges all got their education and learned what they were learning before anybody had a personal computer, which for a while was true. Now, Frank Easterbrook and Danny Boggs, I can tell you, are two appeals court. Both are geeks. They both have had computers for a long time and use them. So if you're litigating before either of those, Easterbrook is Seventh Circuit and Danny is whatever includes Kentucky. I don't know which circuit that is. But between those people, you can assume they will actually understand the technology. But a lot of other people, you can. And this struck me when I was looking at some of the early computer crime cases. Because there's a case where somebody basically helps to set up a computer system and is then found with printed copies of a bunch of the software from that he got by taking advantage of his knowledge to intrude on the system. And the question is, what's he doing? And his story is, I was setting up a demonstration that their security wasn't adequate, and I was then going to go to them and point this out to them, and perhaps then expect them to hire me to improve the security. And the alternative version is he was trying to pirate the software. But the trouble with the alternative version, which never, as far as I can tell, shows up in the court, is that if you really want to pirate, this is machine language software, this is not, you don't want a printout. All right, a printout means in order to do anything with somebody, you're going to have to print these 300 pages, and more than that, I think, back into a computer with no typos. What you would do if you were doing that would be to save it to a disk. I mean, this is a long time ago, but there were disks, even if they weren't as nearly as dense as ours are. So the fact that he had all that paper is evidence against the claim. This is a case that's sort of an interesting case, because I discussed it a long time ago, and of course I was teaching here. This was one of the cases I discussed, and I think I had my notes up on the web. And I eventually got an email from one of the children of the guy in question who had been convicted of a computer crime. And he wanted to know what had happened, basically. And so I told him that my guess was that his father was innocent, that my guess was that his father really had been, he'd really done it. I mean, there was no question but that he had access to computer he had no legal right to access, but that in terms of what he was doing it for, I thought it was very unlikely he was really trying to pirate IBM system software, which I think was what was at issue, which was at that point, I guess, trade secret, as well as that it wasn't just an issue of copyright, it was an issue of they're not letting it out. Anyway, that was but one of the things that struck me reading those early cases, basically, was the impression that the judges really, not surprisingly, didn't understand the technology very well, and therefore, and that's going to be in a certain sense, that's an argument for minimizing legal involvement in new technologies. Because now, less an argument now for, and by now, I presume, I can even observe it in my colleagues. I would have said that when I came here 19 years ago, My impression is that the average law professor here was probably not using a word processor. And that my impression was that the average law professor here didn't really understand computers. That's not true anymore. But that's a change that's happened over your lifetime. So, yeah.
I don't think you really need to say that the judiciary can't participate in new technology or in analyzing technology, but perhaps the individuals who are making those decisions have to be trained or have some experience in it.
But that is, you can certainly try to use special masters and things of that sort, but nonetheless, it's ultimately a judge who's making the decision.
True, but I mean, you can make a technology available. Okay, I studied abroad in Japan, and in Japan, every judge who's going to hear a patent case has to be specialized in intellectual property, has access to members of the JPO who are consultants who will consult with them on any case for any amount of time they want. And they also have on staff technical experts who help them on a day-to-day basis. And I know the U.S. is trying to implement something with the patent pilot program. But the problem is the system is still set up so that a judge with no experience in patent law, no experience in intellectual property, is just as likely to get an intellectual property case. And it just doesn't go anywhere near as far as it needs to go.
But go back 20 years in the U.S. and in Japan, and I think it would be much harder to make what system you're describing work, because you wouldn't have had judges who had or at least very few, and they're not going to be on the Supreme Court if it ever gets to the Supreme Court. So in any case, it does seem to me that on the one hand, I mean, top-level judges are usually very smart people, but if you're a very smart person with the wrong background, you may make very clever arguments that are wrong. So anyway, but it did strike me that it was an interesting issue. So one of the Borden Levine arguments really has this form, or sometimes that form. Another one is to look at areas where you've had a lot of innovation and have never had IP. So style is one of theirs, and you know, certainly as an outside observer who knows nothing at all about style, one's impression is that every year some new fashions come up. And that's sort of an interesting one, because style is a case where presumably being different is itself a virtue. All right? The fact that my computer program is different from your computer program isn't really a reason for you to buy my program. For other people to buy my program. But the fact that the newest dresses don't look like last year's dresses, and you want people to know that you've got the latest style, and I gather some of it cycles around, that you know, you get skirt line, hemlines go up and hemlines go down and so forth. So that's a case where it's almost innovation for the sake of innovation rather than innovation for the sake of progress. Makes one wonder if maybe we ought to have some self-denying art ordinance saying they can't bring out any new designs, because why waste all these resources on just going through the same cycle over and over? But I don't think it's going to work. But then advertising and scientific progress and science, I've argued for a long time, looks a lot like open source software. If you think about the way science has been done for the last few hundred years, you publish your results. Nowadays, you publish your data. Let me say, by the way, going back to statistics for a moment, one basis for deciding whether or not to trust an article which says my statistical analysis shows that the death penalty does or doesn't deter murder is whether or not the author publishes, whether the author makes his data available to be downloaded by other researchers. Because if you go back to the specification search, the cure to the specification search is your data is there on the web. Somebody who has the opposite bias downloads it. He runs his regression. He says, look, by my specification, you get the opposite result. Or somebody who's really fancy says, let's try 100 specifications. Look, two of them give the result this way. One of them gives the result that way. Nothing there. Right? That kind of effect. But similarly, it's been, you know, if somebody publishes a scientific article and he says, you know, my evidence shows such and such, and somebody says, well, what's the evidence? I'm not going to tell you. And there is actually a case like that I came across. Now, I only read one side of it, but there's a very interesting book called The Nurture Assumption by a woman who argued that how parents bring up their children usually has very little effect on the personality of the adult person, contrary to what everybody else has been saying. And she has a later lesson. That book is called The Nurture Assumption. I advise you reading it because it's a lot of fun. Says a lot of other interesting stuff as well. Later book, though, when she's discussing somebody who apparently, by her account at least, claimed to have various forms of evidence from historical stuff and wouldn't tell people the data on which his results were claimed to be based, and she thought they were basically bogus, and that's a reasonable suspicion. But anyway, but in a sense, science looks a lot like open source, and they can say, look, it's a lot of progress in science. Now, we don't know. Would there have been more progress if we'd had, you know, if you hadn't been allowed to use Newtonian physics unless you paid Newton for a license? No way of telling, but I can tell. It's sort of hard to see how you could have made that work. And again, as I say, in literature, you certainly observe not only fantasy, but modern urban fantasy. Zombies are real big, and vampires are real big. And you can see that there certainly is a kind of innovation where one author writes something that works very well, and then other authors copy it. And nonetheless, you know, that mechanism seems to work reasonably small. Well. There's another interesting argument that they make, though, which I think is interesting, again, like some of the other things, because it applies to lots of other things as well. And that's the idea of find some set of private people who have a selfish interest in getting the right answer and see what answer they get. All right? So I sort of liked his sports example. He says, look, if IP is such a great idea, here the sports leagues, baseball especially, has its own private monopoly. I gather that there's actually, I don't remember if it's legislation or case law, which says, in effect, antitrust law doesn't apply to the baseball industry, which is case law. Yeah. But it's true specifically of baseball, I think, not of...
Yeah, there's baseball.
Of other sports. It would be interesting to see, to compare characteristics of baseball with football and hockey and see whether that legal opinion actually affected anything. But his argument is that given the status of the leagues, there is nothing to keep a league from creating IP in what's happening within that league. So if the National Football League wanted to say, our rules are that any time a coach comes up with a new play, he has to submit the new play to our equivalent of the PTO in order for them to decide whether it's a new play. And if they approve, secretly, of course, because they don't want the other side to know. And if they approve of it, then he starts doing it. And for the rest of the season, nobody else can use that play without his permission. All right? That would be it's hard to see why the National Football League couldn't do that if they wanted to. Yet he says we don't observe any leagues doing that. You would think that they have a selfish interest in progress in their sport, that the fans will like it more if the football is getting better and better and more interesting plays and so forth. So why don't they do it? It must be, Fodor and Levine's argument, I think it's sort of an interesting and clever argument, it must be because it's not really a good idea after all. And that going back a step, it's not clear that we have a good mechanism for making good laws. All right. There's something which is sometimes referred to as the Whig theory of history, which views history as progress. And they say, you know, in the ancient days we had feudalism. Then we realized it wasn't a good idea. We improved on that with absolute monarchy. Absolute monarchy has a bug, so we improved on that with democracy. And through everything. And it's not clear there's a very good argument for that. It's not clear, for example, that Hitler was an improvement on Bismarck. It's not even clear that absolute monarchy was an improvement on feudalism, if you actually sort of look at the evidence. And it's not clear that we have mechanisms such that changes in human political and legal institutions necessarily are improvements. This, in a sense, goes to the Posner conjecture. One of the famous things that Judge Posner did a long time ago was to argue that you could make sense of the common law as a set of rules designed to maximize the size of the pie, to create what we call economic efficiency. Might be true, might be false, but he's never really given a very plausible argument for why you would expect it to happen. So if we don't have a good reason to expect the law to get it right, but we do have a good reason to expect the National Football League to get it right, because it's money in their pockets if they do, then maybe we can use the National Football League as a sort of a experimental lab for what's a good idea. And that's an interesting approach that you might think of in many other contexts. For example, The equivalent of that would be looking at the American Arbitration Association, looking in general at all of the contexts where you have, in effect, a private court system, which exists in lots of industries, where the people who are choosing that court system are sophisticated insiders. They ought to know what works. And what rules do they have? Well, that might be some evidence, and maybe we ought to modify the official law using that information. So it's an interesting kind of approach, which they're using here, but I think can be used in lots of ways. Different example, actually. What do you think is the mechanism when your car runs into another car? What is the mechanism for deciding who is liable? The real world mechanism, not the law school mechanism. Anybody know? Yeah? That's what the rule is. What's the mechanism for deciding? You can think of a variety of reasons why one side or the other is liable. Who actually decides who's liable? The insurance companies. That's right. That what's going on is that although in principle it's all decided by the courts, the insurance companies don't want to waste a lot of money on lawyers. The insurance companies presumably believe probably correctly that if they get it a little bit wrong, that means once in a while my insurance company pays you money when they shouldn't have, and once in a while yours pays me when they shouldn't have. It's going to average out. So what they want, and what I gather they use, are fairly simple rules of thumb designed to reduce the cost of deciding who's at fault at possibly some cost in legal error. So that would be another interesting case where you've actually got, and again, the insurance companies clearly have a strong incentive to get a system that works well. All right. So it's sort of a neat approach for looking at that. Let's go back to another example of this argument, which they use, and which is interesting because we've seen it used on exactly the opposite side in our reading, and that's patent pools. All right. The argument that Bolden and Levine are making is, if IP is such a great idea, how come all of the airline airplane companies get together and say, we're going to make a self-denying ordinance eliminating our IP against each other and say that each of us is licensing all his IP, all his patents to the other? And that's the sewing machine industry does it first, I think, and various other industries. So isn't that evidence that these insiders believe that negotiating and litigating over who's violating whose patents is cost more than it's worth in innovation? So that's their argument. What's the version? Where do we see patent pools before? What were patent pools an argument for last time we saw them in the book? Anybody remember? They were an argument in favor of IP on the grounds that if the IP gets in the way, then the companies can opt out of it. All right, this is go back to Coase. This is the Coasean version, as it were, which says, look, we start out by defining a set of rights, but as long as people can transact over those rights, they can rearrange them into the efficient form. All right? So Bolden and Levine say, we observe that they do rearrange them. That suggests you got the starting point wrong. Whereas the counter-arguments say, well, sometimes they rearrange them. But after all, even if they're going to rearrange them, the fact that before the patent pool exists, my entry card to the patent pool that's going to be formed is my patents. So you could say the patents are working as an incentive for the initial innovation, because each company wants to have some patents so that when and if there is a patent pool, they'll have something to contribute so they can get to use everybody else's invention. And then we eliminate all of the deadweight costs of having all these transactions by the companies getting together and having a patent pool. So that would be the counter-argument. And then Bolden and Levine's response to that is, well, that's very well, but once the patent pool is formed, they can now exclude new entrants. And that, therefore, reduces innovation. It doesn't do any good if you invent a really good improvement on the airplane, but the other 93 critical improvements are all in the patent pool and you're not allowed in yet. Now, the people on the other side say, yeah, but if you have a really good improvement, they will let you in exchange for getting your improvement. So, don't know. Anyway, but it did strike me as an interesting kind of argument. All right, let me... Yes?
Going back to the NFL, using the NFL as kind of why would they do it? I was wondering, Maybe if you look at the data, certain big games, you know, high-risk private world games,
yes.
With narrow kind of margins of winning, maybe a coach is likely to save that from that time. So in that sense, to extrapolate to the IP world, maybe he's holding off, maybe they're holding on to the invention until it becomes useful, and then they release it. So if you want to have the invention earlier, that's maybe not the best way to do it. My code is just saving it.
Might be. The... Let me, since you people weren't sufficiently brutal about criticizing the book, let me see if I can point out a couple of other things that seem to me to have problems in detailed articles, detailed arguments. And let's start with one which I thought was sort of interesting, where they're taking immigration, and they're making a legitimate point that immigrants are, in a sense, innovators. The first person from, Poland, the first basically sort of Ashkenazi unwashed peasant from Poland who takes the risk of coming to America. That's a dangerous thing, but what's he doing is generating information for his friends and relatives when he writes back and says, yes, indeed, the streets are paved with gold. It's wonderful here. And so he said that's the case. They have no prior, and yet they do it. But he then goes on to say, but nonetheless, we can see that there's enough reward for the early entrants because look, old money is rich. All right, that's that we think of old families as being influential, well off, and so forth. There's a minor problem with that argument, and that is he's looking at the survivors. All right, the 18th century and before, I don't remember the figures, though I've seen them, but the mortality rate on immigration was horrendous. It was like half the immigrants died in the first year. I'm not sure if the number is that high, but it was that kind of number. You had a different environment. You had somewhat different diseases running around. Presumably, unless you were rich, the voyage over was going to be pretty unpleasant because you were getting, crammed into a ship on a long ocean voyage back when this was sail. So saying the people who survived ended up doing well, doesn't really tell us. And even aside from dying, if you've got 10 immigrants, and one of them ends up very successful, his descendants are going to be a whole lot more visible than the people. I mean, one thinks at least of the Appalachian hillbillies as being early immigrants from, I guess, Scotland and places like that. They're pretty poor. Maybe they're not still poor, but they were poor last time I heard about them. So I think there's a real selection problem in that particular argument. Another point, and this one, now let me make one qualification which I ought to have made before, and that is what we're reading is not the final published version of the book. It's the version they put up on the web. And I have the published version, but I've been reading the same version you have, so that we'll be commenting on the same text. I read the published version, but that was a couple of years ago. Actually, I read the book in manuscript a long time ago. And so some of my critiques, they may have fixed by now, I don't know. But one of them that struck me as really weird was when he's looking at the question of what do companies say patents are good for. And the claim is, I think he claims that only about 10% of the things they say are good for are what the pro-patent theory says. And he's wrong, because one of the big ones is preventing competition. Well, he may not like preventing competition, but the standard IP theory is, why do we give him a patent? Because they're going to get money in two different ways. They're going to get money by licensing the patent, which he does include, and by practicing the patent while excluding other people and thus having the advantage of the better technology. So that ought to have gone in his evidence for, at which point it goes up from 10% to 50%, I don't know, whatever, something like 50%. So that was just sort of one example. There are he has a number of cases which seem to me dubious having to do with genetically engineered plants. And the problem here is that this is an area where there are a lot of people who have access to grind. So that I think they are picking up, that is Bolden and Levine, are picking up on a literature where they're at risk of the same thing that we worry about when we read them, namely believing one-sided arguments. And if you actually look at the two examples, I think they're both wrong. That one example is a kind of basmati rice, where, if I understand the story correctly, and maybe I'm getting it wrong, an American company crossbreeds basmati, a strain of basmati rice with a strain of other rice, and patents the crossbreed. And according to what they actually are quoting in that book, the Indian government's objection to this is it wasn't really original because the characteristics they're claiming for the crossbreed are also true of the existing basmati rice. Might be right. If it's true that it's not an improvement, then having a patent on it isn't going to hurt anybody. All right? Furthermore, according to that thing, the patent was not enforceable in India. It was only enforceable in the U.S. So the claim that is the way they're putting it makes it sound as though the U.S. company was somehow preventing Indians in India from growing basmati rice, and that can't be right in terms of the story that's being told. It has no effect on their ability to grow it in India. It might affect their ability to export it to the U.S. It wasn't clear from the story whether or not the patent applied to foreign-born, was enforced on imports. Sometimes I think our patent law is enforced on imported products, as I understand it. Let me go back a step. There are two different arguments they could be making about patents on genetically modified crops, one of which, as far as I can tell, is simply factually wrong, and one of which could be factually right, but has only some of the bite they want. Let me see if I can run through those, because I think it's a distinction they weren't making and should. One is the claim that when the new crop comes in, that farmers are prevented from doing what they could do before. So that's the implication, if you carelessly read that basmati story, that the Indian farmers couldn't grow basmati rice anymore without paying licensing fees. And I think that's clearly false if you look at the details of the story. Similarly, with regard to the Iraqi situation, they say that here farmers had been replanting seed from their crop for thousands of years, now they can't do it anymore. But unless I'm missing something, they can only not do it if they're using the genetically modified seed, which they didn't have before. So therefore, the idea that somehow they've been made worse off by not being allowed to do what they could do before is not, I think, right. Yes?
The other thing I thought was weird about the Iraqi example was that, I mean, theoretically in Iraq it would still be, they wouldn't be bound by the patents in the U.S. There would have to be an independent patent in Iraq in order for there to be jurisdiction to enforce the patent. So,
but the claim that was being made, and I don't know the facts of it, is that this is when the U.S. is occupying Iraq, and that the occupying authorities are somehow bullying the Iraqis into enforcing U.S. patents. Now, whether that's true, I don't know, but I think that's the claim that's being made, at least. But there's a different argument. So that argument, I think is wrong. But that argument runs through a lot of the anti-GM literature, as far as I can tell, involves two different claims. One of them is the claim that somehow genetically modified foods are evil, are dangerous, are poisonous, and so forth. And I had one in a different course that I taught. I had a great paper by a student it's a science fiction paper, in effect. It was a paper describing a future legal controversy in which somebody had inserted human genes into vegetables for some bizarre genetic, and the critics then falsely claimed that these vegetables were like growing fingers and stuff, and you know that there's really. And the question was, were the critics liable in defamation law for such claims? It was quite a fun paper, which I enjoyed. One of the benefits of teaching when you have ingenious students, But in any case, as far as I can tell, and maybe I'm wrong, there just isn't any support for that claim. And in fact, pretty much everything we eat is, in a sense, the result of human engineering, just with more primitive tools, just by selection over long periods of time. There's a second argument, which is not absurd, although I don't think it's right, but it could be right. And that's the claim that if what you do is to engineer into your crops herbicide resistance, that in some cases there are weed crops that are closely related to the crops you're growing, that the herbicide resistance spreads to those weed crops through pollen blowing, and you then have herbicide-resistant weeds. And that's certainly logically possible. And I don't think that there are any real-world examples where it's been a problem, but I could be wrong. But in any case, it's... But then there's the third argument, which is the claim that this is making things harder for farmers who don't want to use genetically engineered crops. And there was a fairly high-profile Canadian case, which I actually read up in some detail because I was curious about it. And the claim was that this poor, innocent farmer, who is not licensing Monsanto's product, but whose neighbors are, and is not allowed to grow his own corn because it's got some of the genes from... If you actually read the story, what appears to be going on is that there is a road running along his border, which his neighbors are moving crops through with a certain amount of spillage. He is taking the soybeans or whatever it was that are growing in his field right along the road. He is spraying them with the herbicide that the Monsanto crops are engineered to be resistant to. He is taking the ones that survived, planting the seeds from them and spraying them. All right, what is he doing? He is deliberately trying to breed back to Monsanto's patented strain. And I may be wrong, but I think that's what's actually going on. And then he's complaining that Monsanto's losing when he does that. But anyway, but there is an argument. I'm sort of getting distracted because this whole genetic engineering stuff, which actually is an area which is going to be relevant, is relevant to IP, obviously. But there is an argument that Boulder and Levine are also making, which might be right. And that argument is that if you have genetically modified crops which are an improvement, and if it is costly to grow them because of patent law, then the first world farmers who have money grow them and the third world farmers don't. And the third world farmers are now a competitive disadvantage. The third world farmers can grow the same crops they grew before. They can get the same yield they grew before. But meanwhile, the first world farmers are getting a higher yield at a lower cost because the genetically engineered crops are whatever, or they're herbicide resistant, so you can, or take the better ones. They've got a built-in herbicide, a built-in insecticide. There's one of the standard genetically engineered things. There's two of the important ones, I gather. One of them is having genes from a bacterium or something which result in the crop producing stuff that kills insects or repels insects. So you don't have to spray them. And the other is resistance to herbicides so that you can get rid of your weeds by spraying Roundup on them without having to actually pull the weeds. But whatever the reasons are. So it is logically possible that these improvements with patents make poor farmers poorer by having improvements they can't use and their competitors can. But of course, the same thing would be true of lots of other technological changes, with and without patenting, right? Suppose the technological change was not genetically engineered crops that were patented, but a better form of mass irrigation or a better form of tractor, which again, the poor people can't use. In general, anything that improves capital-intensive agriculture as opposed to labor-intensive agriculture is going to be an advantage for people in countries that have lots of capital and not much labor, and that's going to make people in the opposite situation worse off. So that's a legitimate argument, but I think it's a bit of a stretch to think of it as really an argument against IP, and I think it's harder to get people emotionally excited about the claim this thing has made our competitors better off than it is to make them excited about the claim we're not being allowed to do what we've been able to do for all these years. So in that sense, I thought that the genetically modified part was one of the weaker parts of the argument they're making. And there's one other point that would only occur to an economist, and that is, suppose the argument I've just given is right. Further suppose what may not be true, that Indian farmers are producing mainly for Indian consumers. That is, suppose that it's not an export industry. In that case, when the improvement comes out in the U.S., and the result is competition that drives down the price of rice, it is true that Indian farmers are worse off, but Indian consumers are better off because they're buying it. All right? So that the argument is really an argument about making poor people worse off only to the extent that the low wage capital poor country is competing in exporting to other countries, which that isn't true. I mean, that's what depends on the argument. And it's a kind of point we'll very often miss. There's a tendency in arguments for people not to think about the fact that lowering the price to a producer is also lowering the price to a consumer. And I ran into this a very, very long time ago. Back when I was in graduate school, I spent a summer as a congressional intern. And the congressman I was working for had, for some reason, introduced a bill to abolish about half the farm program. And I don't think he thought it was going to pass. I don't know why he did it, but I was all in favor of that. And the Agriculture Department came out with a study of what the consequences would be of abolishing this half of the farm program. And it found, if I remember correctly, that it would cost farmers $10 billion a year and would save the government only $5 billion a year. They didn't mention that the $10 billion a year it was costing farmers was the result of their having a lower price for their crop and would therefore be balanced by a saving to consumers, so that the net was a saving, not a loss. All right. Anyway, it was an interesting experience just in terms of seeing how basically bogus academic work can be used to support one side. Of course, it's used on both sides routinely. I not uncommonly see bad arguments for things I'm in favor of as well as for things I'm against. But it was nonetheless an interesting experience from that standpoint. I think probably everybody should spend one summer in Washington just as part of your education. This is like my argument that the only real federal aid education program we've ever had has been the draft, that being in the army ruled by the government for 2 years is a very educational experience. But still, I'm glad they abolished it. All right, let me think about what other things I had wanted to discuss. There's a point which they don't get into and probably didn't occur to them, and I probably ought to point it out to them for their next edition. And this is related to the argument that when the industry gets fairly developed, it starts getting special favors. And they're seeing it in terms of having resources. But I want to argue there's a more general pattern if you think about the economics of politics, as it were. And I want to take the example of tariffs, which is where I've thought about it more carefully. Tariffs are import taxes. Suppose we have a competitive industry in the U.S. with open entry, where anybody can join the industry. And the result is that there are no excess profits, that if investing in this industry gets you more money than investing sort of in a random bunch of stocks, more people invest in it, that drives down the price. So we now say, well, this industry, we're presently producing half of the consumption of rice in the U.S., and we're importing half. The rice farmers say, let's do something about this. Let's have a tariff against foreign imports. In the story as I've told it so far, it's not going to do them very much good, because they have the tariff against foreign imports. But then more Americans grow rice. If the price of rice goes up, they drive the price back down to what it was before. So in general, it doesn't do much good to have a tariff if competition and open entry means that the potential benefit of getting rid of one bunch of foreign competitors will just be wiped out by domestic competitors. But actually, it doesn't quite work for farmers. And the reason it doesn't quite work for farmers is that agriculture has one resource, one major input in fixed quantity, namely land. So what actually happens in my story with the rice farmers is that when you put on the tariff, all of the land that's best suited for growing rice is already being used for growing rice. So now when the price of rice goes up because of the tariff, the result is that agriculture spreads to land that's not as well suited, and the well-suited land is now making out very well because you're having a higher price because the marginal rice is being grown at a higher cost. Generalize this, and the argument is that getting favors from government is much more valuable if there's some fixed resource owned by a small number. The more owners, the rice farmers still have a problem. And the rice farmers' problem is there are a lot of rice farmers. They'll benefit by the tariff, but they'll never get the tariff. Why won't they get the tariff? Because each rice farmer will say, well, if you guys go and lobby, that's great, but there are a million of you, why should I put in my bid? But if there are only three rice farmers, now it works much better. So the ideal situation for getting the government to give your industry a special favor is an industry with a small number of firms and with some fixed resource, such that the result of increasing the demand for your product is to bid up the value of that fixed resource. Does the logic of that make sense? Because it's something which I haven't seen very often yet. I think it's pretty clearly right in terms of public choice theory, of economics of politics. Now, land is one way, but a different way of getting that effect is suppose you have a declining industry. Suppose you have an industry. Let's take the steel industry. My steel company has got this great steel mill. And because of foreign competition or something else, the steel mill is not worth building, but neither is it worth scrapping. All right, the steel mill is a sunk cost. So it would that making that steel mill would cost $100 million. Owning the steel mill gives you $1 million a year. Not worth, bad investment, 1% return. All right, but better $1 million is better than nothing, so I'm still operating the steel mill. Now, if we put up a tariff and get rid of the foreign competition, what happens is that for a while the price of steel can go up and nobody builds any new steel mills. Because steel mills, until it goes up a fair amount, aren't worth building. So until the price gets up to the point where they, where that steel mill or one like it is worth building, we don't have new entrants and all of that extra money is going to us. It's resulting, it's what economists call a quasi-rent. It looks like rent on land, but it's the return on a sunk sunk expenditure, which, like land, isn't expandable because it doesn't pay to expand it. So that then suggests part of what may be going on here is that the point when the industry is sort of solidified and developed and you know done all these great things, and you have a few big firms, those firms have sunk costs in brand name, in software they've already developed, in the skills of their people. It isn't worth duplicating those. They were worth doing in the growth period, but they've got them. And therefore, if we can keep out new entrants, we can do somewhat better. So I think that's at least I'm not sure it's right, but I think it's a possible story that they're missing about why you might get the unattractive pattern that they're describing. Right. And I'm pretty sure it's the right story. That part of what's interesting in the tariff case is that one of the standard arguments for tariffs is the so-called infant industry argument. And the argument is that you have an industry which once established could be profitable in your country, but in the early stages they're just learning how to do what you can, and therefore you've got to protect it from foreign competition so the infant can grow up. And the problem, of course, is that infant industries don't have any lobbyists. Senile industries have lobbyists. And so if you look at where you actually get the tariffs, the U.S. software industry didn't come about because of tariffs. The U.S. steel industry was a very old industry, or the auto industry, which got tariffs. Because politically speaking, it makes political sense to give the protection to the declining industry, which has got fixed assets, which nobody's going to duplicate, but which are worth something, but would be worth more if we protected them. So that's sort of an interesting case. Yes? Senile.
Senile, okay.
As opposed to infant.
Okay.
All right. All right. I've run out of things I wanted to say. If you have things to say, say them. If not, we'll all go home.